Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Linden, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And we're back on a frequent topic, certainly a very, very important topic for this program, the global economic crisis. And I'm delighted to have on Henry C.K. Lill. Henry developed an interest in economics and international relations when he participated in interdisciplinary work on urban and regional development as a professor at UCLA, at Harvard, and at Columbia. And he's now chairman of a private New York-based investment group. Henry, I'm delighted to welcome you to the program.
Oh.
Can you hear me all right?
I hear you.
Oh, you're coming in. You're breaking up just a little bit.
Hey, is it better?
Oh, I think it is better. If we have a problem, we'll just we'll disconnect and call you back. But let's see how we do. Well, we have this economic situation that's been going on since they don't just spring up overnight, as you know so well, Henry. They kind of germinate over a long period. And when the public finds out that something is not quite right, those in the know understand that it's been brewing and getting worse. I guess just like a lesion that develops into a cancer, if you discover it early, you can watch it grow if you want to do that. But this thing has been around. There were those who sounded the alarm early in the present decade, but certainly by 2007. This thing was beginning to show itself publicly. And finally, the media began to catch on very slowly. And you had reports, but nobody really said that it would be anything that bad. And even now we have endless reports of so-called green shoots. Oh, my goodness. And, of course, the stock market has had a big rally. So clear skies, coast is clear, everything is fine. Don't worry about a thing. If you lose your job in your home, well, you know, that's the way it goes, and maybe in the months ahead, things will get better for you. Well, I'm very interested in your take on this, Henry. I don't see these same green shoots that other people do, and I think all the people being harmed so grievously would agree with that. I see an awful lot of money being shifted from ordinary people to bankers who got us into this mess in the first place, and you wrote a recent article talking about shifting the wealth burden to the working poor. So I'm very interested in your take on this whole thing.
Okay. Well, actually, several people predicted the crisis maybe as long as 5 years ago, and I was sort of one of them. But certainly you're right that the mainstream had been suggesting that the boom, which was driven by debt, would go on forever as long as the central bank could handle the monetary situation. But to understand how we came to the situation today, we may have to go as far back as the beginning of the 20th century. The Gold Standard Act, for example, was enacted in the United States in 1900 under President McKinley, and it was a election between McKinley and William Jennings Bryan, who was a populist, and the issue was essentially between free silver and the gold standard.
Oh, dear. Henry, I need to interrupt. That music means there'll be a break. Let's take that break and come back and pick it right up. Oh, William Jennings Bryan, Cross a Gold speech.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour, talking about the global economic crisis with Henry Lill. Henry, I love going back, and sometimes you have to go back a long way to discover the roots what has led us to where we are today. So please pick it up where you left off.
Okay. Since the Civil War, the election in 1900 had a clear issue of major difference between the two political parties. There was the question of free silver, which became symbolic in the conflict between capitalism and agrarianism, between the Hamiltonian concept of a nation dominated by big corporations and the wealthy elite that control them, and on the other side, the Jeffersonian ideal of economic democracy behind populist agrarianism. Now, McKinley won, and with it, he established the gold standard. And free silver was money that favored the majority of the people. The gold standard favored those who have access to and control of big capital. Put America on the path to become a strong, powerful economy, but the price it paid was that it essentially abandoned economic democracy. Now, labor, on whose back wealth is created, has never commanded control of monetary policy in the history of the United States, even today. And despite the fact that central banking was adopted by Congress in 1913 with the accompanying objective of promoting full employment as well as maintaining the value of money, and the full employment side of it has conveniently been dropped by every Federal Reserve board. Now, the gold standard actually 30 years later led to the Great Depression. Because a fixed value of money itself does not stop speculation. It, however, makes it impossible for the central bank to introduce the so-called quantitative easing, which is increase the supply of money in the event of a credit crunch. Now, everybody knows that the Great Depression was essentially caused by over-speculation. You heard popular reference to the margin call, which caused many, many speculators to go under. And those are facts. But out of the Great Depression, a lot of scholarly studies has been made, which came to counterfactual conclusions that supported certain myths that are not necessarily true. The first myth is that somehow if the central bank has aggressive monetary measures, it would save any economy from economic depressions. That is not true. I will go into later on why that's not true. The second myth they created was that world trade must be maintained in order to prevent a depression. And that is also not true. The third, and most importantly, is that only capital can create employment, okay? And that is really fundamentally not true. Now, going back to the first one.
By the way, Henry, all of this, you're talking about an analysis of the Great Depression, but all of this is very relevant today, because we see these policies, I mean, this massive amount of debt creation going on the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. I mean, just pumping out trillions and trillions of dollars. So whatever was true in the Great Depression has to be a lot truer today.
Right. And the reason I point that out is that these three myths are behind the policies that the current central bank and the Treasury is behind their reactions or their so-called recovery programs. Now, it is true that central bank quantitative easing could sometimes moderate any recession and or depression, but it does not work if the crisis itself had been caused by excessive central bank easing. It only worked if the central bank had been very tight during boom time, and then when the bust came, they eased to relieve the credit crunch. But in this particular case, and also actually in the Great Depression, the cause was already caused because of excessive supply of money. So to further increase the supply of money would only make the situation worse. Now, the second point is that they said that, well, the depression went on because world trade stopped and because of protectionism. Now, this is also a myth, because if you look at the situation today, one of the problems that contributed to the situation is because of globalization of neoliberal world trade, which has a very predatory terms of trade that created the global contagious interconnectedness, so that to continue world trade under the same terms will in fact perpetuate the depression rather than end it. Now, finally, is that the conclusion was that in order to save the depression revive the economy, you have to be friendly to capital, because only capital can create employment. Now, this is fundamentally the problem. If you look at it and think about it, it is full employment that creates capital, because without full employment, you have no savings. And even though with no savings, there's no capital available. Today, most of the capitals come from pension funds. And so you should turn that around and say that the truth is that employment creates capital. Not capital does not create employment. And most of the measures introduced today by the Treasury has to do with preserving the institutions that handle capital. And in fact, allowing them, in order to be profitable, to continue to lay off the workers. And very little, very, very little attention is being paid to stimulate full employment. Today, you take Obama's job creation program, for example, it costs something around $250,000 to create one job. Okay, but to create one job that pays $60,000 a year, it just simply doesn't make sense. And so where's all that money going? All that money is going to profit, and the excess profit is the reason why we have this mess today, because we have a situation where the price level of everything is higher than the income of of the population, so that you have factories that produce products that the people who are making these products can't afford to buy, and we have overcapacity, and overcapacity means economic stagnation and depression and so on.
Henry, everything you're saying, it makes so much sense. And you and I know that in government and on Wall Street and big corporations, they hire a lot of smart people who know all of this stuff, and yet we have our government aligned, I say conspiratorially, with these bankers, the big bankers, and I just like to lump them, the big ones, together and call them Wall Street. They're deliberately putting out these counterproductive policies that, they may pump up profits or inflate another bubble or create an illusion of prosperity in the short run, but they're simply taking a bad situation and making it worse. And I like to think in one sense of what is going on now. I mean, we have these bubbles that burst, housing and equities or whatever, and the dot-com bubble bursting back in 2000, that may have been the beginning of it. And then we had a three-year respite, and suddenly we have the current situation going on. And maybe what they're doing now is creating the ultimate bubble, the bailout bubble. And if they succeed in keeping this thing going and going and going, then it could be they'll have a crisis on their hands that when it finally bursts, nobody, God Almighty, will not be able to solve that problem. Humpty Dumpty will fall off the wall, and we'll who knows what it will take to put things back together again.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Henry Lill, talking about the economy. Henry, I certainly agree, and I think your point is essential, that you need healthy consumers to have a healthy economy. So how on earth can we have a healthy economy by enriching bankers, but millions of people are losing their jobs and their homes? And maybe the pace of decline is slowing a little bit. I mean, it can't go on at free fall speed forever, but it's still pretty dismal. And, of course, the government cooks the books on the data that they put out, and then they quietly revise things later on, and nobody pays any attention to it. So the revisions can look worse than the original numbers, but that's the way it goes. That's the way they do it. And the consumer is over two-thirds of the economy. So if people don't have the wherewithal to buy the products and services the business provides, how on earth can you have an economic recovery? And they don't have the money to buy this.
That's right.
So we have the situation where the former bellwether corporation on the planet, General Motors, went bankrupt. To me, if that's more than a canary in the coal mine, I mean, that is a screaming siren saying, we have a very, very sick country, a very, very sick economy. Something is very wrong, and we're just whistling in the graveyard, thinking that just look at all those green shoots out there.
Yeah.
I think it's insane.
Well, you mentioned green shoots. I think a more appropriate analogy would be poison ivy. They're both green.
I quoted somebody else who used that very term.
But what's happening is that all the new money has gone into the financial institutions to not only bail them out, but to turn them temporarily profitable. But all this money is being used by the institutions to deleverage, to meaning that to cut down the amount of debt that they hold. And so what we have is a shift of the debt from the private sector into the government sector. The debts have not been extinguished. They just moved from the private institutions into the balance sheets of the central bank. Now, what that does is that it has no impact on the real economy. So we're spending all that money that somehow future taxpayers would have to pay into, because they have really government deficits or new money. At the same time, the real economy is not getting any real benefit. So you have a situation where the green shoots begin to look very look better because you know the stock market has stopped falling, but at the same time unemployment is continue to rise. Well, granted, it's supposed to rise at a slower rate, but you know eventually when you have the higher the percentage of unemployment, the slower the rate would fall because, you know, there are only so many people you can get out of job before the whole economy collapses. But so what you have is a collapse of the prices because nobody is buying anything. So they say, oh, well, don't worry. No, there's been no inflation. But what we have is an inflation of what I call profit inflation and price deflation. And price deflation under this situation is essentially company have learned to make a profit in a shrinking economy. And that means that that's a very dangerous situation because if the economy appears really bad, then we'll force the government to adopt measure that really you know, would help the economy. But now we have an image that the economy is beginning to recover. So government no longer need to do anything. And what has happened is that a sector of the economy has recovered somewhat and protected by government money. The rest of the economy is still going down the drain. Now, if you go back to the end of the Second World War, economics essentially focuses on domestic development. Every nation is using its intelligence to focus on how to develop its economy. Trade is only used to augment domestic development. Those aspects of domestic development that requires imports or exports would be assigned to international trade. And in fact, in that time, at the time I went to university, cross-border flow of funds and capital was not only considered unnecessary, it was in fact considered undesirable. And now, with Bretton Woods, at the time, since the American economy was the only economy operating at full steam, the dollar naturally became the reserve currency.
Let's take a break on that, Henry, and we'll come back right after the commercials.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm with Henry Lill talking about the global economy. You mentioned Bretton Woods, Henry, in 1944 when it was clear that the so-called Allies would defeat the so-called Axis powers. So they devised a post-World War II financial system with the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And it's been that way ever since. We had gold backing until Nixon ended that in 1971. But the bankers have pretty much ruled the roost all the way along.
Well, when Nixon disconnected the dollar from gold, it actually started the process, what I call dollar hegemony, which is essentially in international trade, the United States could run a trade deficit, and which is paid for by paper dollar, then the exporting countries take these dollars, but they cannot use these dollars at home. They have to first convert them into local currency. And when they do that, they would create inflation because the wealth behind these the local money has been shipped to the United States. So they are forced to then take the dollars and reinvest it in the dollar economy, mostly buying U.S. treasuries. So under Clinton, Bob Rubens observed this and decided that this is a really good game, in the sense that the United States can continue to run a trade deficit, and that would be financed by a capital account surplus. So trade became a game in which the United States prints dollars and the rest of the world produce things that dollars can buy. Now, these is the basic predatory terms of trade that created this global crisis. It's not even good for the United States, because the United States then gets spoiled into not having to produce anything. All they do is produce dollars. And eventually, you reach a point where even that game has to come to a stop. And in 2007, that was the time that this bubble burst. But what you have today is an international trade that pushes down wages all around the world, not just in the exporting countries, because if American wages were to rise, plants would be moved to lower wage areas. And so American unions and Canadian unions have no bargaining position at all. And so with the global wage level continually dropping, and with global prices continually rising, you will reach a situation where everyone in these economies cannot afford to live the way they have been living. And they, for the last 10 years or so, they've been surviving this situation by watching their houses go up in value. And everybody seemed very happy, because you can take out equity loans and pay for your vacations and new cars and so on. But what they don't really understand is that they have gradually trapped into a situation of living in a house that their income cannot afford. And eventually, as soon as the house prices begin to fall, their house will get foreclosed, and the banks get into trouble. The banks get into trouble. The companies that borrow money from banks get into trouble, and there's these companies and lay off the people. So they not only lose their house, they lose their jobs. But on top of that, they will also lose their pension, because the pension funds are the money that have been investing in these mortgages, and they're not collecting. So in this crisis, unlike in the 30s, where you only lose your job, okay, here in this particular crisis, you lose your house, you lose your job, and you lose your pension, which is the main difference between the Great Depression and the depression that we're witnessing today. Now, you look at this globally, the global capitalization of all the companies that have shares sold in stock markets was around $60 trillion at the peak before July of 2007. And today, it's around $32 trillion. Okay, half of the money, the wealth, is gone. Right? And on commodity, the highest at the highest price level before 2007, between then and now, commodity prices also lost about $10 trillion. And real estate also lost $10 trillion. So you essentially have about $50 trillion of wealth that disappeared.
Okay? I think it's fair to say, Henry, that at the peak, the valuations were pure illusion.
Yes, well, whatever it is. But anyway, this is the wealth that the people have been counting on to live on, okay? So what the government is saying is that, all right, we're going to spend future money, future taxpayer money, to cause the recovery. But the recovery that they have in mind was to push this bubble back to its original size. So they have, to date, so far, spent about $10 trillion, $11 trillion, or eventually they spent $20 trillion. So there's still $30 trillion gap. But this $20 trillion they spent has no impact on the real economy because it's good money after bad. It's just going there to pop up, as you said, values that were illusionary. Okay. Now, if they were to say, all right, we accept that the wealth in the world has now fallen 50%, and we just accept that. We now spend $10 trillion rebuilding it from that new level, and that means that there'll be jobs, there'll be activities, economic activities. But now the $10 trillion that we've spent creates no economic activity. It only creates financial manipulation. And this is why the government's program for recovery will not work.
I absolutely agree with you, Henry. I am not an economist. You are an expert. I am not an expert, but I can read. I have a decent education.
And you have common sense.
Well, common sense, and I'm also in my mid-70s. I've been around the track a few times, and I've seen lesser versions of what's going on today. I've heard all the hype, and I listen to this stuff, and I read this stuff, and I say what bothers me most is that people can be fooled over and over again, and the next time they're told fairy tales like we're being told now, they swallow it hook, line, and sinker again, and then only after they've been hurt more, they discover that they were fooled again. People need to realize that we are being scammed. Our wealth, as you say, and others, and we've discussed it on this program, there's a great wealth transference that's been underway for years from our pockets to the richest folks around, mainly the financial industry, the big banks, the whole FIRE sector, finance, insurance, real estate. And these people are getting rich. As you say, they're not growing the economy. They're not solving this terrible economic crisis. And on this program, I've had economist Michael Hudson come on a few times, and he talks about the heart of this problem is leveraged debt. So what are we doing? We're trying to solve a debt problem by piling on more debt. It's like throwing fuel on a raging blaze, thinking that that's going to put it out. Well, it'll make it worse.
Yeah.
I mean they can short term inflate another bubble, unlike a raging fire, but it's only going to make it worse. And heaven help us at some point where we have a situation that there's no way in the world you're going to be able to solve it. So. My goodness, are we talking about economic Armageddon?
Well, I mean, it's bad enough to pile debt on debt, okay? But it's worse. It's really tragic that the new debt is being piled on the wrong people. And when the Federal Reserve takes on $10 trillion of toxic assets, from the banks, the people who have to pay it back are the taxpayers, you see. Now, what's happening is that the media is trying to create the illusion that somehow we are bottoming and that it's now time to jump back in and for the ride upward again. And I think... It would not be unreasonable to warn the audience of this program that all the green shoots that you are being sold to you are really poison ivies. It's going, they're trying to get your what remaining wealth that you still hold to jump back into the market and get wiped out again in the next round. And the next round would be that this new so-called profit bubble of the corporations and the banks will burst. And what remaining pension fund, which already lost 50% of their value, will lose another 50%. So by the time most people retire in the next 4 or 5 years, your pension fund will either go completely under and bail out by government, and or you would get about half of what you have anticipated or what they promised you.
Oh, indeed. So, Henry, you run an investment company. What advice do you give your clients, and what advice can you give to my listeners on how they should protect themselves given everything that you've laid out?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm in a position to give advice on a program like this for among other things, legal reasons. But generally speaking, I think at this time it is extremely dangerous to think of investing. This market is a trader's market. In other words, if you want to put money in at the low and then sell at the high, and because that would be possible because this is a period of high volatility. So that you can, if you know what you're doing, you can buy low and sell high. But if you're talking about long-term investment, just put your money there in some safe shares and not worry about it for 10 years. I think your chances of coming out ahead is very, very slim.
Well, of course, the big question is what's low and what's high back in after the 1929 crash, as you know. Things were dismal for about a month, and then there was a big, big recovery. And
you can buy, for example, you know, last month, if you buy Citibank, which is really a very toxic share, at the right time, you could have 100% return on your money in a week.
In a week.
So you lose the bank again the next week.
Well, no, if you're an insider, Henry, you would know exactly when to buy them and when to fold them.
Yeah, but well, it's not that difficult to if you watch the Dow Jones, for example, you can pretty much anticipate a pattern, and if you buy and sell every week, your average is such that you may, you know, win 60% of the time and lose 40% of the time. And then, so it's possible, but you know, it requires a lot of time and a lot of nerve and maybe a lot of sleepless nights and worrisome weekends. It's hardly worth the trouble, but a lot of professionals are making money in this market.
It's a very tough way to do this. You need to know what you're doing, and most people's certainly, absolutely should not get into that maelstrom because they'll have their head handed to them.
Of course, but the point I'm making is that in this depression, not everybody is suffering. Okay.
Oh, indeed not. Indeed not. And the successful traders love the volatility, so they can play it going up and they can play it going down.
That's right. And see, hedging used to be a protection device. But over the years, hedging has become a profit center, and that's what's creating, in fact, a lot of this volatility. I mean, you know, you asked me my view on advice and so on. That's why I get into this area. It's not something that I would encourage anybody to do.
Oh, absolutely not. I have never done it my entire life. Actually, I did a little bit with a small amount of money when I first began investing, Henry, and I had a tennis friend who was my stockbroker, and he led me down the primrose path, and everything was lovely until it stopped turning lovely, and what took a few months to make a few dollars took a few weeks to lose it all.
Yes, well, of course, because it
was a wonderful lesson that I learned, Henry. It was a cheap, wonderful lesson. This is not the way to put away money for your future. You're gambling and you're taking big risks and you don't know what you're doing. So absolutely don't do it.
Yeah, you probably would have more fun just spend the money going to the movie.
I'll go to Las Vegas. You can watch nice shows in the evening after they fleece you of your money during the other hours. But overall, it's a very hairy situation that we're in right now. And the discussions that I have on this program with other top guests like you, Henry, they pretty much paint a similar picture. We have a very, very grave situation. And whatever it might look like today or next week or next month, it belies the deep decay, economic decay and problems that we have that are affecting people so badly, and this is not going away in a hurry. We need to go away for just a couple of minutes, Henry, and we'll come back, and I'll let you finish up with some final thoughts.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. Last segment with Henry Lill. Henry, we keep going back to this topic again and again. We'll have more of it later in the week and the week after and the week after that. And I hope you'll come back and add your insights on a future program. It's so crucial. And my last comment was this is not going away in a hurry. And we might see a few breaks in the clouds. But, boy, those clouds are there and they are thick. And they extend over the horizon, and a lot of people will be hurt very badly for a good deal of time to come. But your final thoughts on what's happening?
Well, I think it may do some good for America to reconsider this notion of the political independent central banking. The difference between central banking and national banking is that national banking would handle the monetary policy for the good of the economy, whereas central banking would handle monetary policy for the good of the currency at the expense of the economy. Now, in a democratic society, the people really ought to control the central bank and turn it back into a national bank for their own benefit. The idea of an independent central bank operating on some voodoo economic theory and which has repeatedly turned out to be wrong is blatantly undemocratic. And I don't see how a democratic society like America should tolerate that. But essentially, until we correct this problem, the American economy and therefore the global economy will continue to have a cyclical crisis.
Henry, I agree totally. We talk on this program about a privately run and owned central bank. And for me, that goes right to the heart of our problems. And I wrote about abolishing the Federal Reserve Abolition Act that Ron Paul has been sponsoring to no avail several times over. And if I remember right, I think since the Fed was created in 1913, we've had 19 recessions, including the Great Depression. Well, now that speaks wonderfully about a successful central bank. Without a central bank, with the government printing its own money, we might not solve all these problems, but we'd solve the biggest ones.
I agree. And it's not a matter of left and right. This is actually just by now it's a common sense problem.
Oh, without question. Well, here, Ron Paul, a conservative, he's been the leader in the Congress on abolishing the Federal Reserve, and probably is strong against doing that are the Democrats.
Yes, of course, the neoliberals, who essentially is for big government, which is all right, but they use big government for the wrong purposes.
Oh, indeed. And we have a wonderful system. We have socialism for the rich, as I've said a few times. And we have the law of the jungle, free market capitalism for ordinary people who get chewed up when things go sour the way they are now.
That's right.
It's a terrible, terrible system. And it keeps getting worse because the crises, you build up these enormous bubbles and the crises get worse. And the possibilities of how bad it could be looking forward, well, who can know? I'm not too good at predicting the future. But things are bleak, Doc, and who knows how bad things might be and how many millions may be hurt. And it worries me that the people in charge simply don't care.
Well,
with that comment, that music means they're going to break away, Henry. Oh, I wish we could go on. I hope you'll come back and we can have another discussion like this.
Hi.
Henry, thank you so very much. This was a very, very informative hour. And we do want to continue this again. And do join us again tomorrow. We'll shift to another topic. And later in the week, we'll be back on the economy again. Please tune in.